Blog Talk Radio.
Hello? Oh, damn. Hello, everyone. I think I'm live at this point. This is Janet Parker, and I'm calling from Lawrence, Kansas, and this is Medical Whistleblower. I just missed one of my callers, unfortunately, and I'm hoping that she's listening now and will be calling back in. We had a glitch, and we're a little late in our getting started today. We are dealing with today a spirit within, and I want to encourage you, if you are a caller or expected to be a guest on the show, please call back in as we are waiting for you to get into the lobby here to be let onto the show. We are lucky today to have with us a minister, the bishop from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And he has a congregation here in Lawrence, Kansas. He has been a wonderful spiritual support for me. He's a very spiritual man and a spiritual leader of our town. And I am very, very privileged to have him on board to help us discuss this very important issue of the spiritual strength of whistleblowers. Those of you who have been listening to our show before are well aware that Medical Whistleblower is an advocacy network for persons who report medical fraud, abuse and neglect of patients, and also human rights violations. As you are also aware, most of our whistleblowers, because of their ethical background, their moral considerations, their religious training, they have made the choice to become a whistleblower because they had spiritual strength, that they had teachings when they were children and as they were growing up and through their adult years. And most of them have had persons from the religious training, from the ministry, who are trained in the various faiths, whether they be of a Christian background, whether they be of Buddhist background, whether they be of Muslim background, whether or not they be Jewish faith. Each and every one of our whistleblowers ends up needing to identify with their faith again to get themselves through this situation. So with no further ado, I'm going to place us back on the line with Bishop Peter Steinle. He is such a very humble man, but a man of great faith and great spiritual guidance to me. And I did want to acknowledge his wonderful support of me for the last 2 years that has meant all the world to me. With no further ado, I will let him speak a little bit about his own spiritual strength, how he is able to share that strength with others, including me, and how he is able to help persons who might be of the Mormon faith. And, of course, his message is universal for persons of all faith.
Thank you very much, Janet. I am pleased to be here today, and as I've heard over the last couple of years about the Medical Whistleblowers organization, I appreciate the dedication of people who will do what they feel inside is the right thing to do, even when it puts them at great personal risk and is a difficult choice to make. In introducing my faith and the name of the church is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and here in the Midwest in Lawrence, Kansas, we're not too far from Missouri, where our church has some history that I think is a little bit similar to some of the struggles that medical whistleblowers face, some similar kind of adversity. And I don't know if you're aware that In Missouri, it was legal to shoot people from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints until 1976. It was actually an oversight, I would say, but in 1838, Missouri Governor Lilburn W. Boggs accepted one-sided information, and ordered that all Mormons be driven from the state or be exterminated. That winter, thousands of people were forced out of their homes and off their lands and out of the state. In June of 1976, Governor Chris Bond rescinded that extermination order and formally apologized on behalf of the state of Missouri for the suffering it had caused the Latter-day Saints. And you're probably familiar with some of the sufferings of the Mormon pioneers as they crossed the plains and were kicked out of one state after another. They headed from Missouri up to Nauvoo, Illinois, and then finally had to leave the United States and headed out west to what is now Salt Lake City in the Utah Valley. But there's a lot of suffering throughout the world from people who do the right thing, obviously. But one thing that doing the right thing does is it does give us peace. There's a fantastic book called Leadership and Self-Deception, Getting Out of the Box by the Arbinger Organization. And one of the main points of this book is that we have to do what we know and feel that we should do in order to feel peace and to be able to move on and focus on results. The book is not written from a religious point of view, but those of strong faith will recognize true principles that eternal truths that are part of any religious belief, I think. So I want to talk about this for a moment. When we are faced with a decision, we can either, we have the feeling that we should do something. It may be something very small. If we choose to do it, we feel good and we move on, and we may not think of give it a second thought if it's something small. But if we choose not to do it, then it becomes a much more complicated issue, because when we don't do something that we think we should do, we, of course, feel guilty. And I would add to what the Arbinger organization says, not only do we feel guilty, but that guilt either turns inward or outward. If it turns inward, we feel depressed for not heeding our conscience. Sometimes we become angry with ourselves and perhaps depressed, costing us productivity and joy and our own confidence. When that guilt turns outward, Arbinger explains that we begin to justify. We seek justification for our refusing to do what we knew we should have done. We may justify by finding fault with others, by glorifying our own goodness, at the same time that we find faults or invent faults or see faults that may not actually be there in others. We're putting on the proverbial dark glasses, choosing to no longer see clearly. And the result, of course, is that we feel worse, because we know we are unfairly blaming and finding fault with others. And to massage that guilt, we look even harder, because we desperately need problems in order to justify our unfair treatment of the other person. And if we don't find sufficient evidence to numb our guilt, then we find innocent ways to provoke the behaviors that we seek to find fault with. In other words, we trigger our own mistreatment. It's sick. Remember how we got going in this downward spiral? On perhaps a very simple matter, we were traitors to our own thoughts or feelings, and we chose not to do what we thought we should do. So in that situation, the guilt is rightly placed right on ourselves. So we need to choose carefully. When we have a feeling or a thought that we should do something, we need to choose carefully. Be very introspective and honest with ourselves, because our life depends on it. You might say that sounds like an exaggeration. Our life depends on it. Well, here's a story that I've heard in Mormon churches in a variety of states. I don't know its origin. It may come from the Jewish, Protestant, or Muslim traditions. But it's a story of a group of young people who were on an outing, and they came upon a poisonous snake, and one of them was bitten. And rather than provide the life-sustaining care for their stricken friend, in their anger, the youth gathered stones and pelted the snake until it was dead. But, of course, by then, it was too late to save their friend. There is another story that applies to the adversity that we face when I'll just say the adversity we face. I call it the monkey trap story, and perhaps you've heard that in some countries and jungles where there are these little spider monkeys that are move very quickly through the trees. The natives try to catch them for food, or in one case, a group from a zoo was sent to catch some of these monkeys and bring them back unharmed. And when they went down, they found that the monkeys were so quick, they were not able to use nets or grab them or use snares. But they noticed that the monkeys loved coming into their camp and finding shiny objects. And they would play with them and leave them around when they went down to the stream to get water and so forth. And they decided to use the monkeys' like of shiny objects against them. And they took a coconut and they would cut a hole in the top of the coconut that was just big enough for the monkey to fold up its hand and slide its hand inside of the coconut. And then they would put a piece of shiny tin about the same size as the circle they cut out inside of the coconut. And the monkey would, and then they anchored the coconut to the ground or to a fallen tree. And the monkey would see them put the shiny object in, and it would hop down from the tree. And after the men went away behind the bushes, the monkey would come up and reach its hand inside, wrap it around that shiny piece of tin, and try to withdraw the tin, and of course not be able to get his hand out now that it's encompassed the piece of tin. The men then could come out from behind the bushes and run up to the monkey, and even though the monkey howled and spun around on that log trying to get its hand free, it would not let go of the tin. And they could simply come up and thump him on the head and wrap a gunny sack around him and tie a string around that bag and replace the piece of tin, and another monkey would come down and reach in that coconut and get himself trapped. And of course, the thing that one would want to scream at those monkeys if they're going to be eaten or carried off captive is, let go. Let go of the silly piece of tin. When we are offended or face adversity because of the actions of others, the tendency is to want to let everybody know about it and to hold on to the frustration and the anger and the hurt that has come from those who are unfairly charging us or causing difficulty for us. And there are many things in life that we need to, like the monkeys, we simply need to let go of it in order to move on. From a Christian background, we would use the term repent or forgiveness. We need to let go. We need to forgive those who have offended us so that we can be healed and move on. In the Mormon tradition, Christ is the center of our faith, the center of our religion, and all that we believe in. And Christ, we believe, paid for our sins. And that is why we can repent and be forgiven and find peace. What we sometimes fail to remember when we are most hurt by others is that Christ also paid for the mistakes of those others that hurt us. And then, and Christ also commands us to forgive others. In the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we place our faith, of course, in the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament. But we also believe in modern revelation. And in the book of Doctrine and Covenants, which is a compilation of revelations given mostly to or through Joseph Smith by Jesus Christ, there is one commandment that we are to forgive others. And I think that Christ commands us to forgive others as much for our own benefit, if not more, than for the people that we are to forgive. I love the story of Abigail and David in the Old Testament. When David has, and his several hundred men, have protected the sheep of a wealthy man there in the desert for months. They have not stolen the sheep. They have helped protect them, and all the shepherds know this, and it is expected when they provide that service. The norm in those days was to receive payment. And yet, when David and his men go to receive payment at the slaughtering season, at the end of the season. Instead of receiving payment, they are sent on their way and spurned. And Abigail's husband is known as a wicked man and does not pay them. And when David finds out about this, he tells a large portion of his men to strap on their swords, and they are going to go and extract payment and destroy this wicked man and every man in his household. And Abigail, if I had another daughter, I would seriously consider naming her Abigail, because she is just an incredible hero to me in this instance. Abigail prepares payment. She prepares fig cakes and meat and sufficient payment, and she goes out on the road and meets David and his men, who are hopping mad, and they are going to destroy. They are going to exact payment. And Abigail kneels down and asks David to take out on her allow her to pay for the sins of her husband. She knows and that how David will respond, and this cools David off and prevents David from committing many murders that he should not have really been planning to commit. So she helps him to avoid committing murders by acting as a type of a savior and asking him to let her pay for the sins of her husband. And what a valiant and spiritual woman to help David to see his error and help him to forgive. And of course, Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ and the judgment will take care of those who trespass against us, but we will be the ones to suffer, just like the girl who was bitten by the poisonous snake, or the youth that was bitten by the poisonous snake, by taking out their frustrations on the snake. Their friend ended up dying from the poison. And of course, when we fail to forgive others their trespasses against us, then we are the ones that suffer more. And really, aren't we saying to our Savior Jesus Christ that we don't believe that he paid for the sins of those who trespassed against us? The greatest peace that I believe that we can find is by forgiving others and letting Christ begin to heal our hearts. Janet?
Thank you very much, Bishop Steinle, for your wonderful advice to us. And as I pointed out before, the bishop has been a wonderful support to me for the last 2 years as well. But I have found much support in my fellow whistleblowers as well, and with others here. And I was wondering if I could ask a woman, a very dear friend, who is from the Episcopal Church and very devout in her faith, if she would share her own experiences. And she has faced much adversity and trial in her life and has had to reach very deeply inside herself in order to be able to move forward with her life with hope and rejuvenation.
Hello, I'm Edith Williams. I am a home health aide. I am a certified nurse's aide. I have been a medical whistleblower. I was working in a nursing home one time when I saw a resident being cared for in a way that I thought was not proper. I notified the authorities, and I was pleased that they did respond, and some changes were made that made the resident's living situation more suitable. Now, how does spirituality fit into all this? Well, in order to do this, you have to be very brave, and you have to be willing to be unpopular, and you may end up having consequences. And I think the hard thing to do is to keep focused on the purpose, which in this case was to provide good care to our residents, and not to get focused on, I'm right, you're wrong. You know, this is a terrible place. How could you do it this way? You know, those kinds of battles do not accomplish much. So as far as spiritual strength, I find that following a somewhat traditional practice of daily prayer and scripture reading is very helpful. I do not always feel like doing it. Sometimes it doesn't get done until the last minute, but I do follow this every day. But I think when we think about spiritual strength, we have to remember that it isn't what we do, it's what God does. And really all we have to do is just ask and allow, accept and attend, which are the four mottos of my order, which is the order of Julian, the contemplative order within the Episcopal Church. And those four, again, are accept, allow, attend. What did I just say, Jeanette? Anyway, there are four of them. If you can't remember all of them, God will remember everything you need. That's it for me. I'm handing it back to you, Jeanette.
Sometimes the very simple aspects of your own faith can keep you whole. I know that my whistleblowers have suffered very greatly, and one in particular that has great spiritual strength is a man who has been a pilot, and he a captain of an airliner, and holds the lives of his passengers in his hands. And he came to whistleblowing through his need to protect the public, and he has had to reach deep within his spiritual strength. And I thought perhaps he could share a few of his experiences as a spiritual man this time. And this is Dan Hanley.
Yes, good evening. actually, I was raised in a Catholic family, went to Catholic grade school and high school. Used to say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag every morning and go to a Catholic Mass. And then went into the Navy, and that instilled other moral values and patriotic values. I flew in the Navy as a pilot. And in early 2000, as a captain for United Airlines, I was faced with a legal, ethical, moral dilemma regarding safety and security issues after 9/11. And I was faced with whether, I was facing the possibility of losing my job, and I had kids in school, and I didn't want to jeopardize the jobs of anyone else. And I know during a period of two or three months there, I was drawing on something beyond myself, and the examination of my conscience with regard to all those values, mainly the legal and ethical aspects of my responsibility to family versus passengers on an airplane. And I don't think you can find a whistleblower out there who doesn't go through this deepest examination of conscience and experiencing fear thoughts and knowing they've got to reach beyond something beyond themselves or something deep within themselves, whether you want to call that your soul, your higher being, or God. But I do know from my personal experience, I mean, I was never placed in a dilemma like this before, but since that time, it was an awakening for me because I did move beyond myself, and whether you want to call it a spiritual experience, it's just what I think most whistleblowers go through when they get in these situations, because there is this tremendous fear that you have to transcend, and drawing on something you can call fear transcendence courage, but I don't feel like I drew that courage from my ego self. It was from something beyond that, and that really pretty much explained my situation then and forward to present, and I do attribute it to everything else I did into my life, because I did have to digress to everything I learned from the time I was a little kid to make the decision. So it's a horrible path to travel, and nobody has any fun doing it. But anybody that's experienced it, there's nothing else you can call it but a spiritual experience, because it's something beyond you. I don't want to sound blasphemous. God is a three-letter word that has different meanings for different peoples and different faiths, and I've studied all world religions, major world religions, so I'll call it the strength of God, my higher self, whatever, but it was truly an experience, a spiritual experience and an awakening experience for me. It gave me a greater appreciation, and we all suffer for the path we choose, but I can still shave in the morning and look at myself in the mirror knowing that I did what I thought was right. So I'll give it back to Jeanette here.
And I want to thank you for sharing. Yeah. Another woman who is drawn very deeply from her own spiritual strength is a woman who has always held the Catholic faith deep in her heart. And she is going to share with us a little bit of her own spiritual journey, how she, because of her background as a Catholic woman, had found strength within the teachings that she grew up with and that she holds dear to her heart.
Good evening, everyone. This is Judith Grant. And like Dan, I was raised Catholic and went through all Catholic schools, Catholic universities, and like most Catholics, went through my dilemmas, my periods of being distrusting and disenchanted with my faith for a period of time. But I found that God has ways of bringing us around when we're supposed to be brought around. And that's been my greatest strength through the difficulties that I've had as a medical whistleblower. And I think that Dan spoke very, very eloquently about that. It's something that when you're called upon, and Bishop certainly brought that out as well, when you're called upon to make those difficult decisions, you're faced with something that is bigger than you. It transcends your immediate needs. It reaches into a place within you that has been prepared for a long time, probably without your knowledge, probably without your consent, perhaps. But it's a strength that you come to when you are faced with a decision about whether or not to do what is absolutely right, even if it's going to put you in difficulty or potential danger. And that's what medical whistleblowers do. They make that choice. And it's a tough road to go. It's something that you begin to feel you're all alone. Until I found this larger group of medical whistleblowers, and Dr. Jeanette is an angel in my life, I felt alone. The only person and strength that I really had was God, so really I wasn't alone at all. But it's because God has always been there for me, even when my difficulties with my personal church would wax and wane and carry me through, through something. But I always had God as a constant. And my faith has allowed me to grow up in it. I realized that when I've had difficult periods in my faith, it was because I wasn't very grown up. And I needed to face that. I needed to deal with whatever it was that was causing me an issue. And when I was able to do that, I found that my faith expanded exponentially. Because God makes us invite him in. God doesn't force us to do anything. And I don't want to offend any of the audience as well either. God for me is God, and that's fine. Whatever you want to call God is fine, and it doesn't matter to me. I'm happy with that. And I think that in all the faiths, in all the spiritual realms of life that we all will embrace throughout the many cultures in the world, we have to find that part of ourselves that is the most true to our basic values and our core being. And in that place, we will find our truth. And when you're a medical whistleblower, that means that you have been able to take what was necessary in the situation presented, make the right choice, and then follow it through, even through the difficult times. It was my faith, and oftentimes my spiritual community, that brought me to the ability to come through the difficult moments. When I was truly feeling overwhelmed, I could go into a church, I could spend quiet time, I could begin to allow myself to quiet my own thoughts, and then allow God to enter into my thoughts and provide me what I needed in that moment. And that's the most powerful thing you can do, as far as I'm concerned. When you're facing a difficulty, find a quiet place, whether it's in a church, whether it's in a park, whether it's in a boat out on a lake, wherever that place is, find it and let God find you. And that's really the place that I come from that gives me the power to do what I'm able to do on a very limited basis, in reaching out to others, in encouraging others to do the right thing, even when it hurts, in having the courage to go forward, even when others around you who don't understand the situation don't necessarily seem as supportive as you'd like them to be. Probably they are in their own ways, but we have to realize that everyone has their own pathway to take, and ours is sometimes a little bit more difficult, and other times it's a little easier. But in all things, we have to find that integrated part, and spirituality is a very, very necessary component. I guess that's really all I have to say tonight, and I'm going to give you back to Dr. Jeanette.
And that was Judith Grant, and she is a registered nurse and one of our medical whistleblowers. I'm not sure she gave her name. I would like to... can you turn this over to me? Okay, I'm just trying to...
One speaker?
Oh, okay. I hope you can all hear us. I have on our switchboard right now Joni Fearing. She holds a master's degree in divinity from Princeton Theological Seminary. She's the co-founder and executive director of the Foundation for the Advancement of Orthomolecular Psychiatry in Princeton, New Jersey. And since returning to her hometown in Ohio in 2004, Ms. Fearing has become involved in anti-nuclear activism. And she is a whistleblower, and her activism is a part of her own personal experiences. She had a pharmaceutical drug reaction in 1995, and in 1960s, her family's health was compromised by radiation and chemical exposures her father experienced while working at the uranium enrichment facility. She is currently working to bring alternative energy and alternative medicine to impoverished and sickened people of her native Appalachia. And are you on the line there, Jody?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
We would like to hear your little take on the importance of spiritual whistleblowing, of spirituality and whistleblowing. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, and thank you for asking me to be on this panel. I was glad that I got to hear some of the other speakers first, because, you know, when you're trained in ministerial, in that profession, sometimes you kind of become more intellectualized, and it's really good to hear people's own experiences and that real connection with their faith. So I'm glad. Thank you all for sharing that. I did have a reaction to a steroid, prednisone, while I was in seminary, and I had a very similar reaction to, I believe it's Gwen Owens, was a speaker on one of the websites, and I had what looked like a manic response. After recovering from that, I worked at a psych hospital in Trenton, New Jersey. And during that time, met some really incredible people who were working with mental health issues using nutritional medicine called orthomolecular medicine. And all the time I was working at that hospital as a chaplain intern for my education, I had to do an internship there. I kept asking people and wondering why these people weren't tested for nutritional imbalances while they were in the hospital and treated accordingly rather than just given these medications that were so damaging. And it was really hard for me to see that. And after I graduated, I got more involved with these people who were colleagues, many of them, of Linus Pauling and other doctors that worked with him. And we started the Foundation for the Advancement of Orthomolecular Psychiatry, which was a really, really wonderful thing. Sharing this information with people all over the world. In fact, there is a new endowed chair right in Kansas at University of Kansas for orthomolecular medicine, and so a lot is going on in Kansas. We had to close that foundation, sadly, and I moved back to Ohio, and where I learned that my father had worked at this uranium enrichment plant. I never knew before what the A plant was, that it was actually nuclear, and didn't understand the impact that that had on my family, and my parents both died of cancer, and how that affected our family's health. And I got involved in the Episcopal Church here in my hometown and was working for several years toward my ordination. And when I got involved with the anti-nuclear activism, sadly, that did not go well. That did not go over well. And I ended up having my ordination procedure canceled, and was basically told I'd make a better nun and I should move to California and join a convent. So that was 2 years ago, and that has been an extremely difficult situation for me. My spiritual part of this has been, as I was sharing with Judith last night and some of the others, I don't think I could have survived what I've been through, both with the pharmaceutical battles, because in Princeton, pharmaceutical companies, many of them have their home offices in Princeton. So it was a in the lion's den sort of experience. And here, back in Ohio, I'm in Atomic City, where I'm fighting the nuclear plant. So it's a very, obviously very similar situation. And I've been ostracized. I get whispered, people whisper behind my back in the grocery store, because I've been in the paper, I've been on the radio, people know who I am. And it's very, very difficult to feel that I've been pushed away. And when you're in a very, very small community, it's even more difficult because your survival really depends on being a part of that community. And often those are through churches. So I've sort of lost a lot of that connection. So without God and my faith and really believing that these have been callings for me, that I've been put in these situations so that I can be God's agent in bringing healing and wholeness to very ravaged situations, either the psych wards all over the nation, all over the world, or the impact that the nuclear industry has had on people all over the world and their health problems. But for me, it's especially here in my home community in Appalachia. But I feel that lonely walk that we were talking about is so true, and you lose so much career and your sense of self and your place in the world. So without God, I don't think I could have survived these struggles. Also, kind of going, because you lose your career and your income, finding other ways to find an income and really trusting that God is providing. If God wants us to do this work, we have to really have faith that God will provide for our needs, just as Jesus taught, going out two by two, carry nothing, just trust that you will be provided for. And that's sort of the model I've had to live with. And the Jeremiah as well, someone earlier, the bishop mentioned the Old Testament lessons, and I've had that Jeremiah experience where that those words are burning in my throat and I have to share them. I can't turn away. I can't say, no, there's no problem here. I have to speak out. So those are the kinds of things that I've been dealing with. And holding on to your values, your truths, your morals, also gives you back the strength that you need when you're going through this, and trusting, as I said, that God has a plan. He's ordained this. God has ordained this, and that gives strength and peace that God will see you through. Finding others to share in the burden, which has been spoken about earlier, that's so true, and I'm so glad I found this particular group. I really believe this has been God-sent. People of like minds on similar spiritual paths, that really helps. I read the article that Jeanette sent me by K.R. Sawyer on the 5 tests of whistleblowing. And all those things, the values, the loyalties, the justice, inversion, those are all things that I've dealt with myself. Self-worth certainly takes a hit when you're feeling like you're, no longer really a part of the community you're in, whether it's a work community or your town or wherever you live or church or what have you. And it helps to not compare yourself to the worldly success. We have to remember that we're working on a different plane. Also with the values, you know, religious teaching, you would think this would fit right in to what whistleblowers do, and that's not always the case. People don't often see it that way when those faith communities are so much a part of the power structure. And in my case, that is true, sadly. Again, with loyalties in Appalachian culture is very strong. You don't say things about the industries here. You don't say bad things about the way the government is working. Those loyalties, it's very hard to break through that. So getting also to the justice issues, there again with conflict, you wouldn't expect that from a religious community. An inversion, you know, my view of that has been changed. Now, that paper, interestingly enough, that mentions Van Gogh and was one of the people that that the author was looking at. And I don't know, many of you probably know, Van Gogh wanted to be a priest, and he was ministering to the miners, and he would go down in the mines and minister to them. And I'm sure he was also looking at working conditions. And he was told that he would come out dirty, and, you know, and he was told he didn't look like a priest. He didn't act like a priest, and he couldn't be a priest. So he went on and found a new career in his art and shared that with the world. And so we have to look at some of those other whistleblowers that have gone ahead of us. They've found other avenues. They've done other things in giving their talents and treasure and time to the world in different ways. And also, as was said before, you know, God is everywhere, and Jesus taught from boats and on hilltops. And so if the whistleblowing has affected your relationships with your faith communities, there are other ways to find that peace, find that support. So those are some of the things other whistleblowers listening in may share that experience, and just know that you're not alone. And I just wanted to thank everyone for allowing me to share my story today. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. We very much appreciate your perspective from the hills of Appalachia and the people that you serve, many of whom have not had a proper voice in governmental affairs there.
Mm-hmm.
I myself, this is Jeanette Parker, medical whistleblower. I myself am of Quaker faith, Religious Society of Friends. And my faith, my people's faith, allows each person to find their own pathway to inner light and their relationship to God or the greater spirit of things. And a woman who has been wonderful to me, a wonderful support for me, who is a dedicated advocate for the disabled and also a dedicated advocate for the elderly. She works fearlessly in that endeavor and has taught me a great deal about grassroots activism here in my hometown, Lawrence, Kansas. She is a woman of deep spiritual faith who is a member of my own faith community, the Oread Friends Meeting, and she is going to share a little bit of her own pathway.
Okay. My name is Sonny, and I belong to Oread Friends Meeting, and I've been thinking about this all week. Maybe in different avenues. One of the things of, well, Quakers, as with many religions, have multiple different groups, and Jeanette and I belong to what's called the non-pastoral meetings, which means we don't have a minister, or we all have to be ministers, and we all have to pastor to each other and study, you know, not just to really study and share with people. The Friends Meeting have a system called Committees of Caring, which I guess in some respects, you know, make a group effort to pastor, and in my experience have been used mainly for membership and marriages and so on, but the caring committees can be used to help individuals who have to make basic decisions in their lives. People who have a calling which isn't the usual calling, and I would think that medical whistleblowing would be one of those, or any kind of whistleblowing, and I do know, although I haven't experienced myself, I do know other people that have had experiences and generally had a rough time. I mean, it wasn't, their whistleblowing wasn't appreciated, except by some people, but not generally by where they worked and how they made their income. And I see the committees of caring as a viable way to help people, but I also think that in the long run, it comes down to the individual, as so many people here have stated, and their own relationship with God and how they make the decision when something is a calling, when something is a spiritual need that they need to follow through, or when something is just trivia or just a personal complaint. I guess the closest I've come have been some interactions in terms of my special needs children's calling, and it's their needs within the disability education and other interactions. And I think one of the things that I've learned to ask myself, okay, are you just doing this for your child, or is this something that will help other children? And that's been my kind of criterion. When do I, you know, raise the roof, and when do I just say it's a personal thing and we'll work through it ourselves? And I think everybody, you know, has that point where they have to ask themselves, you know, is this something I need to follow through with? Is it God calling me, or is it just a personal nudge or, you know, annoyance? And I think that's where most people are spiritually, and it comes down to your inner faith and your relationship with God and being able to pray, meditate, whatever word you use, and just ask, you know, is this God calling, or is this a personal itch? Thanks, Jeanette.
Thank you, Sonny. You have been a wonderful help to me, spiritual support in more ways than you will. And I also know that she's a spiritual support to many others, not just from our meeting, many here in this whole state and camp, very much. I wanted to make a few statements about a wonderful article called by K.R. Sawyer. Ken Sawyer is a psychologist, and he's from Australia. He is a medical whistleblower. And he looked at who becomes a whistleblower, why did they become a whistleblower, why is it they persisted doing this, and his analysis had been very helpful to me. I think I shared it with some of my whistleblowers. But I wanted to just go over a few of the points of his five tests of whistleblowing paper, which was delivered to the National Conference of Whistleblowers in Australia. And it's an analysis of courage. Many forget that the personal losses suffered by whistleblowers are forgotten by the public, the very people whose interests they hope to serve. It is oftentimes a thankless task.
which is why so many give up and just go on with their lives. Only the very, very truly committed, or those who are very, very foolish, would continue. And even fools find the risk of loss too great to bear at a certain point. And therefore, I have found those that I have met on this journey are those who have been tested in their personal moral courage. There are many ways to show courage. And I have often told those around me that bravery doesn't come with a gun, or a pulpit, or a title, or a megaphone. I remember the words of Mahatma Gandhi, who is one of my spiritual mentors, that there is no higher court than the courts of justice, and that the highest court is the court of conscience, and it supersedes all other courts. And I think for whistleblowers, the court of conscience is higher than the court of justice. And they keep bringing those things that are dear to them, their hearts, and are a part of their conscience to the courts of justice. And we hope that the courts of justice will respond. K.R. Sawyer believed that a test of values occurs when you become a whistleblower. And he believed that the first test of whistleblowing was a test of moral and ethical values. And this is something I have found in all my whistleblowers. They have a very deep spiritual belief in values and morals. No matter what their faith is, whether they are Buddhist, whether they are Jewish, whether they are Catholic, whether they are Episcopal, whether they are Mormon, whether it doesn't matter. They could be Quaker. I mean, the faith is really irrespective of the fact that they hold a deep spiritual belief in ethical and values. And I am a believer in interfaith commonality, that most of our really important religions speak to those essentials of faith, and that these essentials are central through all religions, and that those of deep moral faith and deep religious conviction hold similar values. And this is one of the beliefs held by the United Nations when they put together their Declaration of Human Rights, is that persons of all countries, of all religions, of all nationalities will find a common ability to find common goals and be able to state them clearly. So in becoming a whistleblower, whistleblowers have to stand for something. Their whistleblowing comes out of an act of courage and spiritual strength that they are stating something is so crucial to them. It is a belief system for them. And when they do this, they are immediately confronted oftentimes with an unsupportive governmental bureaucracy, an unsupportive corporate structure that will not accept that value, will try to degrade and belittle it. So they often, the very values that they stand for will be often detracted by their opponents. The opponents try to dilute the true nature of the moral problem facing the whistleblower in society, because this is a way in which they can discredit the whistleblower and make the problem go away. And this is the first test of whistleblowing, is that the whistleblower doesn't bend to that pressure. They basically hold themselves steadfast to their goals. Their values are not something they are willing to give up. And they steadfastly continue putting pressure to change whatever it is, regardless of pressure put on them by employers, government officials, family, friends, coworkers, and others. The second test of whistleblowing is when the pressure is exerted, and we're told to change our story. We just change our story, go away, become silent. Then we don't have to actually have this whistleblowing discussion. Well, the bystanders even join into that. And never is the whistleblower so tested, but everybody else with whom the whistleblower is in contact with is being tested. All those friendships, all those relationships, all those people they share with are being tested. Even bystanders become silent accomplices to the whistleblower's trauma, and they, by either staying silent and not admitting that there's a problem, often become a source of secondary wounding and trauma. Those who sit silently and watch and do not intervene are the propagators of the problem, and they allow the cancer of corruption to flourish and prosper. These are the silent witnesses, act as a backdrop for the efforts of the criminals and the wrongdoers that target the whistleblower for brutal retaliation. The third test of whistleblowing is that is imposed by the justice system. It is a test where the pragmatic technicalities of the law dominate truth and where the statute of limitations often runs out for the whistleblower. The slow, grinding pathway through the legal system of the whistleblower is meant to wear them down. And unfortunately, whistleblowers are often natural conformists, and they believe that the law is the way to get justice. Unfortunately, the whistleblower often finds out that his very values are very little consequence in front of the courts. And in this pragmatic legacy to dominate, the moral wounding of the soul and the deep personal loss of confidence in the very system of government deeply wounds our whistleblowers. Many a whistleblower who believed in the justice system has come forward relying on the protection of law, only to find out that that system is slanted against them so strongly that there's no possibility to win a moral victory. They see their hopes dashed time after time and appeal after appeal, and their right of freedom of expression is often a hollow promise. There is only a faded shadow of constitutional rights under the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, and the 14th Amendment sometimes. There is a monopoly of power of those who have symbiotic relationships to the accused and often show no wish to expose the corruption. And the whistleblower discloses things and often lacks agencies lack independence, and usually there is no right to appeal. And so that was our third test of whistleblowing. Our whistleblowers usually face a statute of limitations, especially in systematic whistleblowing cases, and there is often a re-traumatization of the whistleblower as they go through the system. The fourth test of whistleblowing is the test of inversion. And everyone who is a whistleblower is familiar with this because it's a betrayal of the whistleblower's own belief system in a fair and equitable system, because they find out everything is so very, very unfair. And there is no place to obtain justice. Personal losses are great. There's no eventual success that makes it more bearable. If they finally win something, it's a paltry sum compared to what they truly lost. As Dr. Perez had told us earlier, going through the court systems rarely gives you true justice in the personal loss area. And there is many other losses that cannot be given a monetary value. There's the loss of one's professional identity, the loss of respect of one's colleagues, the loss of position in society, the loss of personal friends and family, the loss of the sense of self or worth, and just to name a few of them. The retaliation that targets a whistleblower is so clearly unfair, and there's a huge gap between the career path of the criminals and the wrongdoers. The greater the gap, the more extensive is the corruption. So often the corruption extends higher and further than the whistleblower ever imagined. And as the whistleblower's own career goes in a downward spiral, often those that are the criminals goes exactly in the opposite way. The targeting of the whistleblowers is often precise, often imperceptible to outsiders. There's always a deniability to that response that allows the persons targeting them to get away with it. There are almost a limitless amount of possibilities of different ways in which those accused can silence the whistleblower. The final test of whistleblowing is the crucial test of self-worth. Because after you've been through the first four tests, you get to the point where you say, am I worth anything? There is something that has to be internally held. Your value has to be within yourself. And this is the point at which most whistleblowers reach most deeply into their souls, into their religious spiritual belief, into their own internal moral system. This is when they are most likely to turn to the religious leaders that have meant much to them, to find the strength they have, to feel that they are still valuable after everything else has failed. When they start to doubt their own self-worth, this is when the perpetrators quickly recognize their weakened status and are not unlikely to gloat and brag about it and exalt that they are victorious. Friends and family exit the supportive network. They can no longer sustain their relationships through the trauma. And this gives a deep personal wounding to our whistleblowers. Loyalty becomes subservient to social pressures of retaliation. And so often, they are alone. I have attempted in my small work to provide them a feeling that they are not and that there are others like they are who have been through the experiences they have been through, and that together we can go through this journey and find a spiritual journey for each person that is unique and individual, built out of a personal struggle, and we hope to a final triumph for the individual. But I guess in my own personal story, I wanted to address one of the aspects that Pastor Steinle started with, the act of forgiveness. I am Quaker of faith, and therefore many would say we are pacifists. And many would say that being Quaker of faith, you don't fight. You're not supposed to be a fighter. But to be a whistleblower is to be a fighter in a moral sense. But you are confronted with violence, and it is hard to not want to defend yourself. But a true Quaker looks inward and asks, how is my opponent feeling? Can I bridge the gap with peace? Can I reach out with mediation? Can I find a nonviolent way to do this conversation? The court systems is basically a battleground. Civil court system is a battleground meant to pit one person against another person in a ritualized combat that's done with words in front of a judge. It's supposed to be impartial and unbiased. So whenever you enter into a courtroom, you've entered into a battle zone. And hostilities escalate when you do that. And yet, most of our whistleblowers, their only recourse is the court system. They're not getting recourse through the normal governmental bureaucracies. And so they are forced to go into court with a personal injury battle, go into court with an employment law battle, go into court with a quid tam battle, go into court with a Sarbanes-Oxley battle. And whenever they do that, hostilities escalate. Some of you who know my personal story know that I had suffered great personal trauma in this journey. And as a result of retaliation, I did suffer a brutal personal attack that included a sexual assault. I also lost a man very dear to me, a man I was going to marry, who was the assistant U.S. attorney, and he was brutally murdered. And so, therefore, I had a great deal of grief and trauma, and I had persons with whom I had reason to be angry. As you move up this story and you try to bring your truth to light, I found myself facing battle after battle with persons who realized that they were going to be looking at some very, very, very hard criminal violations and harsh and stiff sentences if found guilty of what they had actually done. And I am not the only person who was injured in these acts, because the crimes that were done to hide a bigger problem of taking advantage of vulnerable persons. And, of course, my fiancé had family members and friends who were also bereaved. I am Quaker. And as such, I do not embrace the death penalty. And yet, I am a person bereaved of a person I love by a homicide. It is not unusual for someone who has been bereaved in this manner to wish to have some kind of justice done, and especially when the investigation goes nowhere because of retaliation, it is difficult to be on the forgiving side of things. I grew up in a community with Mennonites and Amish, and deep in the Quaker homeland of Philadelphia. And I had friends who were Mennonite and Amish, and they even hold the peace principles even more deeply than I. And I remember one of my friends who was Mennonite asking him whether he would defend himself if he really came up and beat him up. And he was not of the mind that striking back was a good thing. And I couldn't even conceive of that because, you know, it is easy to think that striking back in self-defense is allowable. I spoke to many in my group, my whistleblower group, who are of the Jewish faith. And the Torah is a beautiful book of great wisdom. And I have found much within the Jewish faith to sustain me. Because I am Quaker, I can embrace all the faiths and all the values of many faiths to provide me my spiritual guidance. I found much to be found in the writings of those who had suffered through the Holocaust. And I remember at one point in front of the United Nations, when the German ambassador had refused to admit that the Holocaust had ever happened. And the Jewish people were being asked to forgive and forget and move on with their lives. But they said, we must remember. We can forgive in our hearts and let go of anger. But if we forget the lesson of the Holocaust, if we try to write it out of history as if it didn't happen, we will not learn as a society what we need to learn in order to move forward. So in my own spiritual journey in trying to deal with a rapist and a murderer and an investigative team, that was trying to find the truth. I came to points in my journey where I could have chosen to walk into a courtroom to demand money and fight those legal battles, a civil battle, fight for a personal injury, fight a quitam, fight for this or fight for that. But I would not have made the journey to the United Nations had I done that. Because my journey to the United Nations was done by letting go of that anger in a personal way, but not forgetting the lesson of what had happened. So it was necessary to reach inside myself and say, I have to learn to let go of my anger towards that rapist, or I will not be able to control the triggering factors that are now controlling my life and leaving me in post-traumatic stress. But at the same time, I don't want to forget that we need to get the answers from why that retaliation happened in that way, so we can find out who actually chose to murder a U.S. attorney and who gained by doing that. Because there is a greater good to be had by knowing who would strike out to murder a assistant U.S. attorney in the line of duty in order to silence him in his prosecutorial duty. Because that is a situation bigger than me, bigger than my loss as a person, bigger than my loss as a victim of a sexual assault. And so I guess the act of forgiveness is important within one's person. That is very important. Because you do need to do that to have peace to move forward. And forgiveness doesn't mean forgetting. And it doesn't mean not acting on what you know as a whistleblower, what you know to be true, and what you know to be your ethical grounding, and what you believe that your whistleblowing journey is all about. So I hope that you have all enjoyed this exploration of spiritual space. I have tried to give us a variety of perspectives here, from different faith perspectives. I want to thank all of my wonderful spiritual leaders here for being with us today, because they all had wonderful words of wisdom for us. And I do believe that this is a spiritual journey we take. We do need to support each other. We don't want to be alone. And we do want to reach out to each other for support. And I want to let you all know that you can contact me, Medical Whistleblower. We are coming to you live from Lawrence, Kansas. My address is P.O. Box C, C like in cat, Lawrence, Kansas, 66044. And I can be also reached by my email at medicalwhistleblower@gmail.com. The Medical Whistleblower Blog Talk Radio Show will be probably aired just about once a week at least. We have had a little hiatus here to get ready for this conference. And those of you who have not been able to get in on the webinars, we are going to rebroadcast those this next week. So we hope that you will be able to join us live. And I also have the slideshows from the webinars posted on SlideShare, so anyone who wishes can download them. And they're also available on numerous medical whistleblower sites all over the world. As you know, we serve medical whistleblowers internationally. We're active in human rights protections, and medical whistleblowers are defenders of human rights. I want to thank you all for being with us today. And I hope that you will tune in again. Thank you.